23rd, 2010. We do have a quorum. Present to my right is Senator Meyer. Present to my left, Senator Bundy, and myself, Senator Pascan. I anticipate that Senator Thomas will be joining us very soon. Senator Davis is excused this afternoon. So anyway, it is my intention to bring first before this committee the committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 relating to residential fire sprinklers. I understand that we will have two amendments presented today, and I've asked the bill sponsor, who is here obviously, to address those two amendments. And after that brief invited testimony, if it's the will of the Labor and Commerce Committee, I intend to move the amended committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 from this committee today. Next, the purpose of our meeting is to take up a couple of new bills. One is Senate Bill 296 relating to long-term care insurance. I see the bill sponsor is here, and we welcome her to this committee. And let the record reflect that, as I anticipated, Senator Thomas is here. So we have four members of the committee with us. Anyway, the second bill after 296, we will address the committee substitute for Senate Bill 278, which is version C, relating to leave for military spouses. It is my intent to hear each of these bills and hold them for additional consideration. But to begin, we have the committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 before us. Anyway, I think it's appropriate just for me to indicate that we have had a number of hearings on Senate Bill 129 this year. We on the committee substitute, we met on both March 2nd and March 9th. We've had very forthright and intelligent testimony from advocates both for and against this bill. Public testimony was closed at the conclusion of our March 9th meeting after extensive hours of testimony on the residential sprinkler bill. I mentioned at the conclusion of that hearing that I had set the bill aside, and the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association had offered to prepare and provide to the Labor and Commerce Committee additional information that dealt with this topic, and in particular the municipal code adoption process that was being followed. And I have received that document, and I have shared it with my committee members. And in a letter accompanying that document, the president of the fire chiefs stated, quote, "Our testimony has been that municipalities far exceed the minimum standards of AS 2925020, close quote. And the spreadsheet that was provided to us does support that assertion. And Chief Tucker's conclusion then is that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 is not necessary. On the other hand, the bill sponsor, Senator Menard, contends that the minimum standards for the public process should be extended for reasons that are in the sponsor statement, and she has presented that, as has her staff and others, the reasons why the committee substitute for 129 is appropriately before this committee. And I think that myself and all the members of this committee have respect for the people and the organizations that are for and against this bill, and we also have respect for the arguments that are both for and against this bill that have been presented to this committee. And I guess given that as a introduction, we would welcome discussion at this committee level amongst the committee members and consider the amendments. And I would request that the bill sponsor come to the chair. And while we begin, yes, Senator Bundy.
I have prepared two amendments for the committee in consultation with the bill sponsor, and if you're ready, I would move amendment number one.
Amendment number one, which is identified as M.2?
M.2 by Cook, yes.
Okay. And an object for purposes of discussion.
All right. An objection for purposes of discussion has been made. Senator Bundy, would you explain, please?
Yes, in discussing this with the bill sponsor and others, it thought perhaps enabled to reach both sides' goals more readily. that we would change the at least 60-day period to a 60-day period, but no longer than a 180-day period. I believe those who are opposed to this bill feel like the addition to the 180 days was a positive step. And, of course, those that support the bill want the free and full disclosure that would occur at a local public hearing. So it is, I have an additional amendment that I think also cleans it up a little bit, but let's stop there.
Yeah, let's deal with amendment number one. Is there any purpose of discussing amendment number one?
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
All right, amendment number one, M.2 version is proposed to this committee. Is there any objection to amendment number one? Seeing no objection, amendment number one is so amended.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, Senator Bundy.
Yes, thank you. Encouraged by success, I will go on to amendment number two and move amendment number two, which is M.1 by Cook.
Object.
For purposes of objection, Senator Bundy, please explain.
Yes, this is an attempt to remove what could be conceived by some as an unfunded mandate. And it does delete the cost-benefit analysis language. It is my assumption, and I think others who have been involved in this, that if we have a public hearing, two public hearings during a six-month period, certainly the discussion of the costs and the benefits of instituting or requiring fire sprinklers in residential homes would be adequately addressed. But this removes what, as I said, what could be construed by some to be a unfunded mandate.
Any further discussion needed on the objection?
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
All right. In that there's no objection before us at this time regarding amendment number two, is there do I need to have a motion to bring?
I've made the move.
Oh. Is there any objection to amendment number two? Seeing no objection, amendment number two has now amended the committee substitute for 129. Any further discussion? We would present now to Senator Menard and her staff, Mr. Rivito. Would you please set forth the information you'd like this committee to receive at this time?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Senator Linda Menard, District G. I appreciate you taking this up again. It's been a long and grueling process. A personal favorite for me was the cost-benefit analysis, but in weighing everything and getting cooperation on both sides, both very well-meaning people that want this to come forward as good legislation, I'm certainly relinquishing any argument I have not to keep that into the legislation. I support the amendments at this point, and we've heard from the home builders who say they're okay with the amendment, as well as the realtors are okay. The Alaska Municipal League, and I believe you have copies of that, has stated they will stop opposing the bill with this amendment and take up a position that's neutral, and the 180-day cap was suggested by the firefighters. So with that, I am happy about moving this bill forward, and I certainly appreciate all the hard work and due diligence that we've done so far. Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the committee chair, and I believe all the committee members, we've been a participant in that very grueling process, and we think that this is a major step in the right direction, and we thank you for all the work that you and your staff have put in on this bill.
And thank you. And just one, I know this is redundant, but I just want to say one more time for the record, I am not against sprinklers. It was just the process that I was trying to correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any Further discussion on the amended committee substitute for Senate Bill 129? I would accept a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill 129 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached, I believe it's a zero fiscal note. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, attached zero fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, the amended committee substitute for Senate Bill 129 is moved from the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. We'll take a brief at ease for signing. Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We welcome Senator Liesl McGuire to present the merits of Senate Bill 296. This deals with long-term care insurance and would request that Madam Senator please state her name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee here in the Senate. Senate Bill 296 is a bill that was born out of a working group, and one of the individuals here today to testify on it can describe it to you. The group made up of people in long-term health care delivery and long-term health care insurance began looking around into the lower 48 to see how people were addressing, how states were addressing long-term care strategies, how they were looking at the cost of that. Alaska exceeds the national average in terms of our costs, our average costs for assisted living and home health costs, but overall, all of the states are facing this similar challenge for long-term care. We have, we're fortunate in that our population is aging. We're living longer. But with that comes the challenge of what we do as we live longer and are no longer able to care for ourselves. The national average for nursing home costs in Alaska is, the national average is $198 a day. In Alaska, it's over $618 a day, Mr. Chairman, just to get into the record. The national average for assisted living costs is $3,131 a month. In Alaska, at the low end, it's $4,314, so over 37% above the national average. And then finally, in the last category for home health costs, where you have an hourly amount, it's $21 an hour for a national average and $25 an hour. So Alaska is again above the national average, this time 19%. So the group started looking at the costs of long-term care. And those in the group, and Amy Oney is here, who owns some assisted living homes, can tell you that it's around 90% of the clients that are on Medicaid. So the state is paying in her homes for roughly 90% of all of the human beings that are being cared for. And there are all kinds of issues that crop up with it that she can describe to you. I mean, people trying to shift assets and people trying to find ways to cover long-term care. And unfortunately, as you know, Mr. Chairman, by the time you've reached that point in your life where you need long-term care, your prospects of going into the workforce and changing any of the decisions that you've made prior to that are bleak. So who does that burden shift to? It shifts right here to Alaska, to the state. In the case of those folks that live in the lower 48, the majority of them have a tax base that's made up of actual taxpayers. They've got a personal income tax or a sales tax, a consumption tax. In Alaska, we do not. So we know that 89% of our tax base comes from oil and gas revenue, more specifically the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. That said, we still have an obligation to think about our tax base, because it may, with the reduction in that production curve, it may someday be borne by the individual citizens in Alaska and may change the economy. So the idea behind this bill is to create a premium assistance program within the state of Alaska. And what other states have done to this end is they ask individual citizens of the state to put forward an amount of money from their own wages that would then be matched by the state and then subsequently matched in an equal amount by the long-term insurance provider. So you create a partnership. In the end, a policy develops, and that policy is meant to insure that individual for long-term care in the event that they should need it. Again, in Alaska, there's more statistics that I've asked for with respect to the elderly and how many of them end up in long-term care and assisted living and so forth. But just looking at Alaska's statistics for Medicaid enrollment, and just a reminder as well that Medicare does apply to those 65 and older, but in the case of long-term care, the burden falls back to Medicaid with very few exceptions. So the elderly projection for the state, so those 65 and older, for this next year is projected to increase by 5.1%. We had 8,300 elderly enrolled in Medicaid in 2009, and then 22,300 is projected for 2029 based on that 5% average. So looking at the growth that we would experience in the Medicaid budget for those who would need long-term care, I think it's incumbent on the state to start looking at ideas for how to address that. This is one of those ideas. In this case, Alaska is unique because we have the permanent fund dividend. And this group, and then in conversations with me, had the idea when the checkoff program was put in, finally adopted into law last year, this click to donate program, it caused the group, it caused me to start thinking about what kind of an application there might be for an individual to think both at the time that they're receiving that dividend of how they might want to give to charity, how they might want to look at their own health needs and at their own long-term care options for the future. And I see Senator Bundy on the committee, the resident cynic, and I appreciate that. He'll tell you that, I think, would tell you that Alaskans should be thinking about that already, and why do they need the government to put a piece of paper in front of them to remind them to think about it, and he's right. But unfortunately, we get busy, and raising our children, living our lives, and we don't take that time often to think about it. And frankly, the prospect of long-term care for most of us, particularly at my age, seems daunting and a long way away. So we're hoping with this bill, should it pass, that Alaskans would have an opportunity when they apply for their permanent fund dividend to think about long-term care. We've been working with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and they're here to testify. Deborah Bitney's here to testify about conversations we've had. But what we've tried to do is minimize the fiscal impact to that division. I mean, they get hit all the time by people wanting them to, you know, execute thought processes for Alaskans. But in this case, we will ask that they forward on information about this program to Alaskans, let them consider it and decide. If they do, then they'll be giving $500 of their own money. It'll be matched by the state and then by the long-term care provider. The bill itself, as you walk through it, I have staff here as well to walk through the sectional analysis if you'd like, as well as I'd like Amy Oney to come on record and just explain a little bit about the group and how they came to be. And then Linda Hall is here with the Division of Insurance, and she is aware more broadly of the NAIC's look at this, the other states that are providing these kind of programs and what kind of savings there are. So that's just the 35,000-foot view of the bill. And I'd be happy to stay for questions, but I'd prefer if we could let them testify first, and then I'll just stand by for questions.
Thank you, Senator. If you would please come forward. And you're welcome, Senator, to stay at the table if you'd like, but whatever you prefer.
For the record, my name is Erin Schein, and I'm staff to Senator McGuire. The sectional analysis that we have that's provided, that's what you'd like me to go through?
We're here.
To the mic, please.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, maybe you could position that there a little bit so that we can hear you. And, you know, what we're interested in today is receiving kind of the structure of how this all works, and, we're not... I'm not intending on having a voter to move this forward today. We're just to receive information so that we can start thinking about it. You know, it's obviously a major issue when you bring in the permanent fund and you start bringing in, three parties to this transaction and try to make sure that this fits properly. So I want to be cautious as we move forward. So as much as you can do to provide us with the substantive information on how it works and where you're going.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Chair, sections 1 through 14 conform the statutes to allow for long-term care partnerships, which are in place, I believe, in 23 other states right now. It makes it a group policy that is transferable between the states, and also adds provisions for anyone who is selling or administering long-term care insurance as a partnership to do so, and to do so within the guidelines.
That's good.
Okay. Section, would you like me to go through 1 through 14 each? I'm sorry.
You know, it's I guess your opportunity to make sure we
I don't know to what detail you guys have read, but essentially the first part of the sections establishes the mechanism, which is the certificate that we talked about, mm-hmm. that would come into place once an Alaskan made that election to create the policy. There are some sections that, as you move through this session, and like I say, this may be something that we work on over the interim, that Aaron, through work with drafting and looking at other states, decided to put in with respect to pre-existing conditions, for example. And we've modified that in Section 2. The committee may choose to change that. And then there's the transferability section, which I think Linda Hall wants to talk a little bit about, you know, how that works and whether or not the state should be a receiver of that. I think that's a part that I want to highlight for the committee as well, to consider what kind of liability the state wants to have with respect to entering into these transferability agreements. And so if there's nothing really, Aaron, that you want to add, I just wanted to highlight that, you know, there's a sectional analysis that goes through the mechanisms, but overall you're creating a certificate, you're creating a partnership with the state. The fiscal note is fairly substantial, and I think that's another part of what this committee ought to think about, never mind the nuances of, you know, pre-existing conditions or whether the state wants to allow for transferability and reciprocity. But the fiscal note's pretty substantial, and I think the question really comes down to whether or not we believe in the long term that the state partnering in a premium assistance program would offset some of those costs that come in later on the form of Medicaid claimants. And so as it, you know, as those numbers that you saw, that 5.1% every year increase in the 65 and older category here in Alaska. So by 2030, as I said, we're looking at over 23,000 Alaskans who will be 65 and older. And of those 65 and older that end up needing some form of long-term care, the burden falls, some percentage of those, the burden will fall to Alaska and its coffers. And so, you know, the question will be one of those. Other states have seen a benefit in creating these partnership programs because there's a long-term savings. So that's what I know about it. I'm going to have Amy come up and talk about the group. This is one of those bills by request, and I think it's a really good idea, but it's one of those things where it is highly technical in nature, and I kind of am asking this committee to turn its attention toward the issue and see if it's innovative and see if you have suggestions back.
I don't know if we had you state your name and affiliation on the record. We need to do that, so I think we missed that. So if you could.
Sorry, my name is Aaron Schein, and I'm staff to Senator Sandra McGuire.
Okay. And thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So Senator Bundy has
a couple of questions. I know this is just in an early stage, but and I'm one who shares concerns about the Medicaid costs. And we perhaps need to hear from Department of Revenue, because, you know, the deferred amount is matched by Health and Social Services, and then again that's going to be matched by a tax credit equal to the amount of their contributions. That means that will be a net loss to the state of a potential tax income. And so I'd like to know about what's the net gain here between someone going on Medicaid and actually following this program.
It's a great question. The tax incentive, there's a federal tax incentive, but to the extent that the long-term care insurance provider got a state credit, I agree with you that, you know, you're going to want to add up the dollars in one side and add up the dollars on the other side, and somewhere in between there'll be a nexus. And so it's a great question, Senator Bundy, and if the committee ends up deciding that there's a benefit, I think it's the kind of thing that would be interesting to observe in other areas of the Medicaid budget as well, because it's the one part of our budget that is just growing at extraordinary levels. I mean, and I know you all saw the statistics a couple weeks ago that one in every two babies, 50% of all live births in the state are now paid for by the state of Alaska, as one example. So I think it's a great question, and I know, like I say, Linda Hall is here as well. She's done some general look at this. Again, it's tough to craft for a state like ours because we don't have a personal income tax. So things are always unique, and we've got this permanent fund dividend program. So,
you know, one of the questions that I was thinking about is, you know, my understanding of when one enters into a long-term care contract, you're going to have a number of years where you have to pay that premium.
Right.
In other words, it's not just one-time click. Is this a representation that you're going to do it for 5 years? Is this, you know, 10 years? Is that a fixed amount? And, you know, I don't want to, my concern is people that might just check it 1 year, but then they lose 100% of that money because they don't click it the next year, and then they don't have the benefit. And so you have all of those issues. And so I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
It's an excellent question, Mr. Chairman, and I was just discussing this with Amy before. I don't know if Hank Hodge is online with New York Life. If he's not, we can get him on at another hearing. I just asked that similar question. I said, if you're in once, are you in? And what happens if that very next year you sustain? Because don't forget, long-term care insurance is also for those of us somewhat youngins, getting older by the day, but who fall into a disability category. And so I asked that question, and it was her belief that, you know, by that next year, so long as it wasn't a pre-existing condition, that you would have a policy. But I think those are really important questions. How many years would you need to pay into the policy? And as you rightfully described, you don't want to misrepresent to an Alaskan an opportunity that they then squander by giving 500 to and then not pay into for the future years. So those are details that we need to get in. I appreciate you. This is unusual for me. I have never done a bill like this. I do bills usually that I know the subject matter, I know what they are, and I come at it from a problem I've observed. In this case, it was brought to me by constituents that know and that deal with this every day. And so I appreciate the committee's indulgence and look forward to continuing to discuss it.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Yeah. Thank you.
You did very well.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
I might. One that you couldn't have an answer because it just happened, but how is all this impacted by the Obamacare, what I would term unfunded mandate on our grandchildren, great-grandchildren in some cases, perhaps. And long-term care, you know, you still have to drive people into it there, and so that'll be a part of the discussion. But is that more essential than car insurance or house insurance? And if we're going to subsidize one, and I was here when we had the argument about this permanent fund checkoff, and it does Christmas tree up, and I would certainly see people saying, my car insurance subsidy is just as important as your longevity or long-term health care subsidy. So, interesting questions.
Yeah. They are most interesting. And yes, Senator.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Bundy, great question as well. I asked that about Obamacare, particularly because the definition of a pre-existing condition is now changed, in some cases, to not be considered. And so forth. So that's an interesting question. How does it dovetail? I also asked whether or not there might be federal incentives in the land of stimulus money, if there might be federal incentives that would go toward a program like this. And we'll try to find that out. We will find that out. And then to your point about other categories, I think the litmus test would be whether or not what level the state has a financial obligation in those other categories for unfunded liability. And I think so long as you could make that argument, then giving Alaskans opportunity to do that would be appropriate if the cost-benefit analysis was there. But the issue with long-term care insurance is that, you know, we're paying upwards of $4,000 to $5,000 a month out of Medicaid coffers for those seniors who did not get long-term care insurance, and so that's where the stick is.
Okay. Thank you. I know we have one person signed up, Amy.
Lots of information.
Please state your name and affiliation, and then help us better understand.
Well, my name's Amy Oney, and well, I do have four assisted living homes in Anchorage. Not directly affiliated with this bill, but it's brought to my attention an area that those of us who conservatively would like to generate interests of getting long-term care costs outside of the being reliant on the state, getting them back into the private sector. That's where our conversation started. We generate lots of interesting conversations around our fireplace, and that's where it started. And we have been in an assisted living business since 2002, and I have seen, I have 20 beds. I have never had a long-term care insurance client even approach me. So even though the product's on the market somewhere, I have not seen them on mine, and I've had quite a few clients in that amount of time. And it's painful to see these people who have worked their whole entire lives, spend down their entire savings, and go on to be basically indigent to get into the Medicaid program, because when they were going through the Depression era and they're afterwards, even in the 50s, even fathoming the fact that my assisted living home could cost them $7,000 a month is staggering. You know, for a lot of years, that might not have been in their annual income. So my thought was, what do we do to help these people? My other thought, Senator Bundy, that you actually inspired a lot of this conversation as well, because a couple of years ago, I went to one of our Anchorage caucus meetings, and we were in front of you, as 90% of my clients are Medicaid, and we were struggling against the rate freeze that was in place, and I remember you saying, well, if you don't like it, it's a business decision to stay in and in the environment. And now I come back to you a couple years later and say, you know, my business model and the goal that I have to take care of these residents is actually pretty sound. So maybe it's time to change the environment and find out what's wrong so that we could better care for the seniors of Alaska. So here's what we came up with. If you can encourage people to purchase the long-term care insurance, the partnership program is an excellent avenue to do that. We found there's 22 states, approximately, give or take, at any state right now, with another 10 to 18 in the process of creating it. You can, what it does, it gives you a mechanism to purchase the long-term care insurance. If you purchase $100,000 worth of coverage, you get to keep $100,000 of your assets at the end before you would roll over into the Medicaid program. So you don't have to give up everything you've worked your whole life for, or your husband or wife or anyone else. You can secure, you use outside funds to pay down the initial coverage of any of your long-term expenses, and at the end, you still have a net result before maybe you went on to the Medicaid. But most people, if they go into long-term care, they might have a, I think it's 43% that will need, 43% of adults I read that will need long-term or nursing home at some point. And of that 43%, I believe it went into quiet mode. So 43% of Americans will enter a nursing home, and of these, 55% will stay at least 1 year, and then a 21% will stay 5 years. So that's pretty significant for the amount that you care. If at the current rates, you were in a nursing home for 365 days at $610, that's $222,650 that you would have to spend of your own personal money to be in there. I read in one of these studies that it's about $170,000 that most adults 65 and older have put away for their own retirement. So before the end of that first year, without any kind of insurance, you're going to go into beyond the Medicaid coffers. So,
if you could give us a little information on what the annual cost is right now. So in other words, if Senator Myers, myself, Senator Bundy wanted to purchase long-term care coverage, what are we looking at? And
there may be bad examples. Better
I do have an example.
We couldn't afford it.
And I know Hank, who's in Anchorage, provided these for me, so if he's out there, he can. So the goal is probably set for someone maybe in their 40s to plan ahead, someone who's getting, you know, about ready to retire. Maybe they've done their 20 years teaching, whatnot. They still have some disposable income. They'd be able to do it. If you did a $300 a day nursing home benefit, granted that's half of what Alaska is, but it's much more than the standard for the national rate. Your annual premium, let's see, you get $300 maximum daily if you stayed at your home. You have a 90-day wait, and your policy maximum would be $547,000. Your premium would be $897.87 annual. Now,
$900 annually?
Yes.
And that gives you $300 a day?
Right. Up to...
At home.
No, well, $300 a day if you were in a nursing home, but you can't spend more than $547,000. So if you're spending $220, roughly, you would get 2 years in a nursing home.
So,
and he's online. He could probably give you much more specific details, but this is according to us.
You know, right now, I'm just trying to get a general, you know, I'm understanding that $500 would come from the individual under your system as a checkoff, and then $500 comes from
match, right?
The match, and then there's another match.
Of a discount.
That's the next step that
talking to, and whether it comes as a tax, because that was kind of an extra, we wanted to try and create a three-legged stool so that everyone was giving something. And we've talked to a couple providers out there to get this going on such a large scale. Not that they could offer maybe a group rate, you know, because everyone would, it wouldn't be like buying into a business type thing, but it would be a mass production effort. You know, they could give a 10% discount. And that's what we were trying to make happen, so that you gave some of your personal funds, the state met it, and then somewhere along the way, whether if it was a tax workings that the insurance company gave, but it's supposed to come from the insurance company. It's not supposed to be a double dip from the state. Yeah, it's supposed to be the three.
Yeah. Why in the world is a private enterprise going to give me money for my long-term care?
They're going to give you a discount. Why would anyone not give a bulk rate just to a large corporation? But...
If I could ask it maybe in a little different way, does the state's involvement result in a gross cost savings to the consumer? In other words, I understand the issue of the subsidy from Health and Social Services, but if disregarding where the money comes from, does the state's involvement result in a gross cost savings of any sort?
That is absolutely the goal. I mean, citizen of the state, I see the budget. You can't sustain it. The idea is to decrease the Medicaid budget, and we don't know guaranteed how many people are going to buy into it or what the effectiveness is of it, but we got to reduce that. It's a burden to you, us, and everyone else.
I'm not looking at it for the future payout from the state. I'm looking at it from the premium cost that you are putting on the market. In other words, in the example you gave, $900 annual premium, is that assuming the state's participation in the program,
this
or is that
right now,
the current market?
That's the current market.
Okay, so assuming the state gets involved in that, can anyone tell me that $900 becomes $750? And so that if Alaska is promoting this,
that's the idea.
You know, we get a 18% discount because it's a larger pool.
That's exactly our point. And I think that anyone that gets any company, and that's as we work through it, and I'm sure Linda Hall will have a lot more to say, the companies that we have talked to have offered that, saying 10%. They have said that we're willing to do it. Now, whether or not legally you can give a discounted rate on insurance premiums for what this, that's what we have to work through, Linda, and that's where it maybe becomes behind the scenes as tax credits or savings of some kind. That's a more technical issue than our fireplace could substantiate, so that's why I rely on these guys. But the idea was they're willing to step up. To be on the short list of companies that offer this program, they're willing to give in to.
Mr. Chairman, maybe an answer to your question, but if my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, under this plan, the individual pays $500, and basically he's going to get that $1,000 worth of insurance because the state is picking up the rest of the cost.
It would be a match. It wouldn't be you get a $500 automatically. If you look at the 50 and 60-year-old rates, it's not nearly going to turn out that favorable, but you would never get more from the state than you put in yourself.
Well, no, and that, well.
You would match.
But you see, the premium, the tax credit on the premium is still basically state money somewhere along the line. It's taxes that didn't go to the state.
You know, I do want to get to Senator Wilikowski's bill today, and I can see that we can go on a lot of side trails.
Could
and I
ask one more question?
Certainly, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Ms. Bundy. Did I understand you say now today Jeff bought long-term insurance? He could keep $100,000 of his assets and still go on Medicaid?
Only after, okay. With this partnership, that could happen. If he bought a $100,000 policy under this partnership plan, he would be, if he went into a nursing home, the first $100,000 would be paid by the insurance company. That would come out, $100,000 would be paid by the insurance company. Any assets that he had above $100,000, or maybe it's $102,000 with the Medicaid limits that are out there, he would have to spend down to that level. So if he had $1 million of assets, he would still have to pay another $900,000 down. But so you couldn't underinsure just to get on it. You would have to pay down. But yes, if you purchased $100,000, you had $100,000 of assets, then yes, you could go into the Medicaid.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I'd like to do is, you know, we have Linda Hall and John Sherwood here, and, you know, whether, you know, I'd like to pick up Senator Wilikowski's bill at 3 o'clock if either of you would like to make any comment at this time. You know, certainly you're welcome to come forward if that's appropriate. And I don't want to, I don't want to have it appear like I'm cutting you off.
Absolutely.
I kind of am, but, you know.
Fair enough.
You know, I just, you know, I think that we are in the beginning process, and as I indicated, you know, I don't intend on moving this bill today, and, you know, mm-hmm. we have a lot of work to do. So, anyway, we do thank you very much for this beginning education.
For the record, Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance, and it really wasn't my intent to do anything but answer questions, but as I've listened, I will make a couple comments and let John talk, and I will be certainly happy to finish before 3 o'clock. I would say the beginning parts of this bill through section, I believe it's 14, are part of a model bill through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. What the beginning parts of the bill, without getting into the technical ways in which long-term care public-private partnerships work, is policy description that would allow the Division of Insurance to actually approve a policy form if an insurance company wanted to participate in one of these long-term care partnerships. The policy is different than those we have filed today. And in order for us to approve one, a long-term care partnership policy, we would need this model language. So that's really what the first 14 sections are. And is this on?
It
doesn't sound like it. My staff worked with Ledge Drafting and the NAIC model, and so that's really was the involvement we had from a policy regulatory approval, not the actual working of the long-term care partnership. But I think that the companies that offer those policies in other states then go on to participate in some way in a partnership. But it does, and as I read this bill, the first tax credit is exactly that against their premium tax, which in turn reduces funds into the general fund. So that's really the only comment I wanted to make, was about the fact that this is a model bill from the NAIC.
Okay. Question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And I don't know if, Linda, you're the person to ask, but I believe current state benefit package provides a long-term care option. And if that indeed is the case, I'd like to know what's the level of participation. And two, then, of course, by extension, it would be, this would then provide an option to the rest of the citizens that's currently only available to state employees. Now, with the state employee, if they're buying into long-term care, I don't think there's any state match to that. But if there is, I'd like to know. And, of course, if there is, then do we undermine the state program if we come up with this program? A lot of questions.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy.
Answer any one of them.
Can I take my pick? I'll start with the first one. It is also my understanding, but I don't work for retirement and benefits, that there is a state retiree long-term care program. I think the daily limits are relatively low, and I'm not sure about I would be fairly sure there's not really a match for that. But it's done as a group program. So I think, as one of the prior speakers said, frequently you will have some type of reduced premium for group participation. Although when we look at rate approvals, we do look at that and make sure it's not, quote, unfairly discriminatory. So that's about all of the questions that you asked that I can answer right now.
Okay, thank you.
We would move to Mr. Sherwood if there's some comments. I know you've been listening, and so would appreciate your knee-jerk or whatever her response is. So.
Thank you, through the chair. I'll try and avoid the knee-jerk. I think this is kind of a novel program for our department in terms of looking at administering the program. It's not an area where we have a lot of familiarity doing this. As we've looked at it, we made the best assumptions we could in costing it out with limited experience and information. And I do think, with regard to long-term Medicaid savings, the department is always looking for ways to foster personal responsibility and planning for the future and avoid assuming more of the burden for long-term care in the Medicaid program. There is, when you read the literature, there is some degree of uncertainty about how much these programs actually save Medicaid. A lot of the discussion that I read seems to come down to how many new people does this encourage to get insurance versus just provide a benefit, an additional benefit in the Medicaid program to people who would already buy insurance to protect long-term care insurance to protect their assets. Certainly there is the potential in this kind of program to save the Medicaid money some money long-term. We really can't quantify and wouldn't expect to see it in the sort of the lifespan of a fiscal note that only goes about 5 years out. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you guys might have.
Yeah, I guess just on a very general basis, you know, the assumption is that there would be, in the long term, savings to the state, because then there would be premiums that would be paid that defer the state's obligation. And is there an effective way to measure that? You know, you allude to the short fiscal note period, but is there some analytical way that one could look at that and just say, yes, we will have savings if people buy in and stay bought in?
Through the chair, I'm not really aware of something that would really let us quantify it specific to Alaska. Again, a lot of it, because these long-term care partnerships do provide an exemption when we look at people's assets, to the extent the insurance company has paid long-term care benefits, some people can qualify for Medicaid quicker, and so as a result of having this, because they don't have to spend down their all of their own assets. That's a theoretical possibility. On the other hand, to the extent this encourages more people to buy insurance so that even if they qualify for Medicaid, long-term care insurance is still paying for some benefit, or if the insurance is sufficient that it substantially puts off the point at which they might qualify for Medicaid, then we might see more. But I think there's a high degree of uncertainty, and in terms of knowing what the demographics that would be attracted to this program, to date, I think my understanding is people tend to seek long-term care insurance if they have significant assets that they want to protect. And so, ideally to get the most savings, you'd be wanting something that would reach a broader range of people.
Mr. Sherwood, please state your name and affiliation, just so the
record. Thank you. For the record, my name is John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services.
You know, one of the questions of Amy that I would like to know is what is the not termination rate, but the failure to renew rate that people have if they're buying long-term care insurance? So, I'd like to have, there has to be some industry standards on that, where people start out with the best of intentions, spend $1,000 a year, do it for 3 years, and then just say, I can't do it anymore. And I think that is a policy issue that we need to be addressing if we're going to get the state involved in taking the money.
Mr. Chairman, if I might,
yes.
Those are called actually lapse rates, just for an FYI, but we would be able to find that kind of information from the policies, long-term care policies that are in effect in the state today, and there are about 5,000 of those, okay. Or from other states. We have never tracked or were able to find any statistics about how many long-term care policies in other states are part of a long-term care partnership program. And that was something we've tried to find and will pursue. But it wouldn't be Alaska-specific because we don't have any. But we can certainly look at lapse rates in the general long-term care insurance market.
Okay. Thank you. And that's Linda Hall, I think. Do you need to have her?
Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
All right. Senator Bundy.
I know you're trying to move on, so I don't need an answer today, but I noticed the representative of the Permanent Fund Division here, and I know in the past the PFD folks or Permanent Fund Corporation have been rather resistant to getting these checkoff things because they Christmas tree up, and so at some time in the future it'd be good to hear what their position is.
Well, I'm sure everyone on the committee understands that we have a lot of information that we need to receive before we advance Senate Bill 296 forward, and we've identified probably just a few of those issues today, and we thank Mr. Sherwood and Ms. Hall for being here, and Senator McGuire and her staff, and Amy Oney, and I think there was also one person, Dennis Bailey, who was available for questions, but we thank them for listening in, and hopefully people will have even more questions later. So anyway, what we would do is Senator Wilikowski, we now
brief at ease.
Okay. bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us Senator Bill Wilikowski, and he's here to address Senate Bill 278 relating to leave for military spouses. And we've requested, when we were at ease, for Senator Wilikowski and his staff to come forward, and they have, and we welcome them to Senate Labor and Commerce. So, Senator Wilikowski, please identify yourself and your staff, and then, as we discussed, we don't need to have the full presentation, kind of get to the meat and potatoes, and then we'll start hearing from some people.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm State Senator for Northeast Anchorage, and I'm here with my staff member, George Ascott. And as you recall, this is a bill to provide, to allow spouses of soldiers serving in combat zones to take 10 days of unpaid leave from work while that soldier is on leave from the field of battle. You both sit in the previous committee and have spent a long time with this bill. We do believe we've addressed many, if not all, of the concerns that the committee had at the last hearing. There were two changes that were suggested towards the end of the last hearing, and we've tried to address those. One concern, Mr. Chair, was to fix the language currently describing a period of military contact. And then the other change was to Senator Cookish's request was to clarify that teachers working in schools with 20 or fewer employees are not required to provide 10 days leave without pay, but are also not prohibited from doing so. And we promised Senator Cookish that we would do that. And I'll just have my staff show you where those changes are.
Thank you, Senator. Please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Senator Pascvan. For the record, my name is George Ascott, staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. The changes can be found in the committee substitute, which you have but has not been adopted, 26-LS1034-C. And the first change, which was made because there was an error in the bill that I believe you pointed out, that required that Congress have formally declared war in order for a person in the regular armed forces to qualify for this. It turns out that apparently Congress has not formally declared war since World War II, but they have authorized it. And so those changes have been made clear on page 3, lines 7 and 8. Also on page 5, line 22. And finally on page 7, lines 11 and 12.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And then the second one, we just wanted to make it absolutely clear that teachers that work for schools with less than 20 employees, particularly rural schools that maybe only have one teacher, may provide this leave if they're able or willing to, but are not required to, but they're not prevented from doing that. And that change is found on page 2, lines 1 through 2. Or actually, more like lines 1 through 4. Okay. And those are all the changes that are in this CS.
Thank you, George. Any questions by the committee? Senator Meyer.
Yeah, just one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you explained this before and I just missed it, but how does this bill differ, and what are we attempting to do that differs from the Federal Family Medical Leave Act?
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Through the chair, this is George Ascott here. The major differences between the Family Medical Leave Act and what this bill would do is it would allow more Alaskan soldiers to qualify. The main difference is under the federal law, an employee must work for an employer with 50 or more employees. Our bill would apply to an employer with 20 or more employees. The employee must have worked for a full year under the federal law and have worked a total of 1,250 hours during that year. Our bill requires an employee to have worked to work more than 20 hours a week, for the employer to have more than 20 employees. And that is in response to the fact that military families typically tend to move every couple years. The spouse often is raising children and can't necessarily work for a place for a full year, or hasn't during a deployment, or for that many hours.
I didn't get the difference in hours in per year. In other words, I missed that. I apologize.
Under SB 278, an employer must work for an employer for more than 20 hours per week. So if they work for less than that, it would seem that they probably have enough time to spend with their spouse, possibly, anyway.
And then under the federal laws, I understand it's like 1,200 and some hours as a base.
For an entire year period, and they must have worked there for a full year.
But is a full year defined as 1,250 hours? In other words, that's...
It's both, Senator Pascal.
Okay, I got it.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I can follow up. how did you arrive at 20 employees or more? I mean, in some ways, I like the federal limit at 50, because obviously if you have 50 employees or more, you have more employees that can kind of cover for the person that's going to be gone during this time, whereas 20, you don't have much capacity, spare capacity.
Go ahead. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Through the chair, George Escott here again, we did a review of what other states did, and many of them have a 20 employee limit, and we have not been able to discover that there's been any problem meeting that criteria.
Mr. Chairman, one thing I do like, though, that the correction they made from last time we heard this in State Affairs was I see that you're now requiring a two-week notice, and I think that's good, because that does at least give the employer a chance to get a temporary in or line somebody up to fill. Okay, I think that's all the questions I have right now.
If I could just focusing on the 20 hours per week, so there is no 6 month or 1 year time limit. It's just an employee, if they're working 20 hours, they have to give 2 weeks notice, and then they have the 10 days unpaid leave.
That is correct.
Okay. All right, any further questions? We have several people that want to testify, so first we have Mr. Jeffrey Mittman. Please state your name and affiliation.
My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska, and we just want to briefly state for the record that we had worked with the Senate State Affairs Committee on some constitutional issues in the bill, and we are now fully supportive of the bill. We think it's a great policy decision by the state of Alaska to meet the needs of our military families, and believe that the bill as currently drafted is in compliance with the Alaska Supreme Court's ruling in AKCLU v. Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, we, Al Tamagni?
Yes, sir.
Please state your name and affiliation.
Yes, sir. I can hardly hear you, I'm sorry, but...
state your name.
My name is Al Tamagni Sr., and I'm from Pension Services International, Incorporated here in Anchorage. I'm a small businessman, and we took a look at this bill initially, the House version and the Senate bill, and what we done is that we determined that the other states had passed their bills before the enactment of the Defense Authorization Act of 2010, which was signed by President Obama on October the 28th of 2009. of which a portion of that was encompassed in a public law 1184, section 565. So the other states had passed their laws prior to the enactment of the Federal Act. So what we see is the Federal Act grants 5 days of unpaid leave, and that the proposal in the Alaska provision under this bill grants 10 working days. And I think there is a lot of confusion, perhaps by the sponsors, because in the House version, the sponsors were not even aware of this newly passed legislation. And that's the same approach taken by the other states that were quoted here earlier that had passed similar bills. They had passed those bills before the Federal Act was passed. So what I think we're saying is that the Federal Act has taken care of virtually all of these problems. There are some parts of the bill, as proposed in the substitute SB 278, as far as breaks in service and those items, are all regulated by ERISA and cannot be superseded by state law. And I think the most important thing is there has been no evidence, support at all, where any of us can find that this is being abused by Alaska employers. Understanding there are tens of thousands of small businessmen here in Alaska that are veterans that employ people. And I think the suggestion in this bill is kind of a slap in our face. And I don't think there's really a purpose of having this bill, because we're trying to solve a problem that does not exist. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a problem with the 20 employee versus 50 employee limit?
Well, I think that's one of the problems.
Do you have a problem with the 2-week notice portion?
I think most of us employers, because there are times where deployments happen, or people are, you know, returning, that you don't have a 2-week notice. Because as I know, there's a member of my staff, her husband is supposed to come home, but the military is very tactical, and they don't sometimes say, we're going to arrive at XYZ day at such and such a time. It changes and changes and changes, and that's to protect themselves in the event of a war and attack by the enemy, from knowing precise times that when these transportation trips are going to occur. But quite frankly, I don't see why we need this bill, because the federal law has virtually taken care of everything and exempted all small entities with less than 50 employers under the Family Medical Leave Act.
Thank you. Any Senator Meyer?
Yeah, if I can just follow up on your question, Mr. Chairman, it would I think I heard you answer this question, Mr. Tammany, was that certainly the 50 is better than 20. The way the bill is now, it says any employer with 20 or more employees, and I have never had a small business myself, but it just seems like with 20 employees, you don't have a whole lot of flexibility if somebody is going to be gone for 10 days, where at least with 50, you've got enough employees there where you can hopefully move them around and kind of cover for the person that's going to be absent. So I think I heard you say that the 50 is much better than the 20.
Well, I believe that we need to just, if we just leave the Federal Act, you know, in place, that addresses everybody's concerns.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point. I actually don't know what the difference is
now between the federal act and what we're trying to do?
Well, the federal act allows 5 days of leave for, you know, the spouse. Okay? That's for the spouse. I get 5 days of unpaid leave. What we're trying to do under this bill is to say we want 10 working days of unpaid leave. And we want it to apply for employers with less than or more than 20 employees. The federal act says 50. So it looks like, you know, the biggest concern we have is that there's been no demonstrated evidence of any abuse or any problems. I mean, we check with people in Fairbanks, we check with people in Anchorage, and a lot of these employers are those people that are veterans themselves.
Thank you very much. We now move to Rick Davidge.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we can hear you.
This is Rick Davidge, the Alaska State Council President for Vietnam Veterans of America and Chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation. And with all due respect to my person testifying before me, number one, military families don't always get very much notice. Number two, yes, most Alaska businesses have been very, very helpful for spouses and families so that they're able to spend some time with their warrior. But this is not just dealing with deployment and return. This is also dealing with when a soldier is given R&R time but is unable to return to the country, and the spouse would like to go over and meet their warrior and spend some time with them too, and that's one of the reasons why the 10 days is important. What we're really trying to say in this bill, and thank you, Senator Walchowski, for sponsoring this, is that the state of Alaska wants to make a statement preemptive of problems that it is the position of the state of Alaska to enable at least 10 working days without pay, with given some reasonable notice for a spouse to spend time with their warrior during deployments, overseas deployments. And all of the other concerns are really tangential to that. It's really, that's the core issue. I wish we had kept the phone number of the woman who called us last year, the foundation last year, and I mentioned this too with George. But we did not and we cannot re-find it. She would make an extraordinary witness. Her warrior was in fact wounded, and her employer was unwilling to give her time to go overseas. That was unimaginable to us, and unfortunately we were able to deal with that. But these are the kinds of things that we can't anticipate. So having a law that is very clear that a spouse can take up to 10 days leave without pay to visit their employer once a year is, I think, a very reasonable thing to request. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Davidge. Any questions of Mr. Davidge? We move to Stacy Bannerman.
Good afternoon. This is Stacy Bannerman.
And state your affiliation.
I want to thank you to the committee for considering this important bill to support the families of the troops who are serving or will serve combat deployments.
Yes.
I'm a Blue Star wife of an active duty Army Guard soldier who has already served two tours in Iraq. He received the Bronze Star and Combat Infantry badge. During both deployments, I was working full or part-time for employers for whom the recent changes to the Federal Family Medical Leave Act for military families will never apply. For the first years of the Vietnam War, married men were exempt from the draft. For the duration of the war, married men with children were given draft deferments so they wouldn't be deployed because it was thought to constitute too much of a hardship on the families. During Vietnam, the majority of troops served one tour, and comparatively few citizen soldiers served in combat. The bulk of the boots on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq are married. They have served or are serving multiple tours. Most of them have children. But America doesn't seem to care about that anymore. even as military families are increasingly stretched and stressed to the breaking point. Nearly 70% of military spouses work outside the home. But a lot of spouses, and I've heard from many of them, a lot of spouses are unable to spend precious time with their loved one immediately prior to a deployment, during a two-week R&R, if it even happens, or when their husband comes home. And with every single deployment, we have to make impossible choices between work and family, forcing military spouses to make these choices over and over and over again. When our nation is at war, is the very definition of a lack of patriotism and a failure to support the troops and their military families. Shortly before my husband's most recent deployment, I'd started a new job. I couldn't get any time off from work. After several months of training at Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, he left for Iraq. I didn't see him for more than a year. He returned safely, thank God, but for some of us, the reality is that our soldiers are coming home in a box, and we will spend the rest of our lives wishing for those last 2 weeks of time with our beloved. 2 weeks. Yes, recent changes were made to the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, but that doesn't cover temporary, part-time, seasonal, or contract workers. It doesn't take into account the reality and frequency of relocation required of active duty personnel and their families, the fact that many of our spouses have to cut back to part-time work in order to handle child care and household responsibilities during deployments. Keep in mind, we are the primary unpaid caretakers of our veterans as well. Doesn't take into account the fact that most Guard and Reserve spouses work for small businesses, many in rural communities, or that an increasing number of employers are creating a virtual workplace and hiring contract workers. So in order to be eligible for the federal law, military spouses are required to have been working for an employer for at least 12 months, worked at least 1,250 hours during the prior 12 months, and be located at a work site where there are at least 50 employees within a 75-mile radius. So for all intents and purposes, the federal law is meaningless for the majority of military family members. In 2008, Washington State passed the military family leave law. In 2009, Oregon State followed suit. I strongly encourage Alaska to pass SB 278. It's long past time that the business and civilian communities stepped up and shouldered a small portion of the burden of these wars. Thank you.
Ms. Bannerman, there's a question from Senator Meyer.
Yes. Thank you for your testimony. I guess I'm a little shocked. You weren't able to have some time off from your employer to meet your spouse?
Could you speak up just a little, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, if I understood your testimony correctly, you were not given time off to be with your spouse when he was on...
During neither deployment.
Is that right? And that was an employer here in Alaska?
No, that was in the lower 48.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say...
But my story is not an anomaly. The thing is, we can't afford to complain to our employers. You know, we can't afford to complain. And when you're a military spouse, you know, enduring these deployments, your plate is so full and you are so overloaded, you know, that we don't really, frankly, have the time or the energy or the wherewithal, you know, to be pursuing other avenues and you know, filing complaints. And there hasn't been a lot of support or legislation, you know, so we just suck it up and deal with it.
Okay, yeah, the reason why I asked is because I have never heard of an employer here in Alaska that wouldn't allow their employees off to be with their spouse during an R&R. So so that's why I was asking that question, because Alaska's we really appreciate our military, and we try to accommodate whenever possible.
Ma'am, have you lived in Alaska in the last half dozen years?
Have I?
Yes.
No, I have not. I have lived in Washington State, and I have lived in Oregon State. And one of the things I've noticed is a lot of folks, you know, like to say publicly that we support our troops and our veterans, but... you know, when it's time for the rubber to hit the road, unfortunately, that's not true.
Well, ma'am, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I guess I take a little bit of offense of somebody who lives in Washington or Oregon saying that we don't appreciate and honor our military, because we certainly do up here in Alaska. And that's why, again, I'm just trying to find out who, if any, employers would not give their employees time off.
And I'm sorry if you're taking offense. I didn't say that was about Alaska. I said specifically in my experience, and right prior to that statement, had acknowledged that I did not live in Alaska and had not. So that was a statement of my experience based in Washington and Oregon. And obviously I cannot speak to and not, you know, sorry that you heard it the way that you did. I was speaking to my experience.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Bannerman. This bill does raise significant policy changes, and you know, we're not going to move the bill today. And as I indicated, it was my intent to hold this bill, so we will set it aside for further consideration later. But we are not going to move the bill today. So we thank Senator Wilikowski and his staff, George, for their presentation today. Given that, Senate Labor and Commerce is adjourned for